went home, and I got a letter from my editor, Marv Sosner, said, come on home, a job is waiting. And I said, nah, I'm gonna stay. So I stayed 3 more years.
Till 71.
Till 71, when IBS really fell apart, it was really a mess. But yeah, then I think, well, eventually, let's see, was it Christmas yet? No, it was, okay, maybe that Christmas. But we were doing it in TGU. I don't know what we were doing. I can't remember what we were doing. Mm-hmm. But I just kind of wandered around. And then they said, okay, hey, you want to go to Nepal? And I said, yeah, I want to go to Nepal. Because you go with the ambassador. Because the ambassador to Saigon, Ellsworth Bunker, was the husband of the ambassador to Nepal, Kathmandu, Nepal. And they got an airplane. And they're going up for Christmas to Kathmandu and New Year's. And they could take 20-something Americans, civilians with them. And so you want to go, I said, okay, and I got my passport things and everything. And then just before we were ready to go, the Viet Cong attacked. And the ambassador says, I'm like, I can't believe we're under attack. So our trip was off. So I said, well, here I am in Saigon. What am I going to do now? I said, well, I remember all my teachers, male teachers, they were all drafted. So I got on a bus. I rode on the very top of one of these buses that, and I was the only American. At that time, I often was the only American because I was just hanging around because I could go anywhere. And I got on top of a bus and went to Nha Trang, someplace out in Nha Trang. I don't even know how I got all the way there. And I found the teachers, and they were sick. So I tried to get some medicine. I'm not sure if we got it from the special forces or what. We got it anyway. They got some medicine for them, and hung around with them for a while. I can't remember what I did exactly. I think somehow I ended up back in Quy Nhon, and the school year was trying to get the school year going or something. And I think we got it going. Let's see, 68, 69. Yeah, because we got it going for a couple of years, and then it kind of sputtered along. And then, because I was teaching at the girls' high school and at the boys' technological high school, and at the seminary. Because I like seminaries; those are my best students. And then, somewhere in here, I had a couple of operations. So I had appendicitis, and my appendix burst, and they put me in. They put me in the maternity ward at the missionary hospital in Quy Nhon, and the mother superior operated on me. And she said, boy, it was a tough operation because your liver, your appendix was attached to your liver, which was way in the back. So I had to reach in there and grab it, pull out. And I was in the hospital for 3 weeks or so, 3 or 4 weeks. And then they took me over, and then they gave me a lot of morphine, which drove me crazy. Mm-hmm. And they sent me over to the girls' high school, the college, the teacher's college, mm-hmm. where I got really paranoid. I stayed with the dean, Dean Kentuck Airman, and I thought everybody's out to get me, so I escaped from there. And I was picked up by MPs in front of my house, like, I was telling them that people trying to get me, I gotta get out of here. And my friends were trying to tell me, he just got out of the hospital, he's on morphine, just relax. I said, okay. And then somewhere in there we got going again. And the big education problem that I saw that I could help with was helping the student or organizing with USAID's help, I think USAID paid for it, a school where we could take all of the subjects that the Tutaifan Mot, which are the first baccalaureate and the second baccalaureate tests, take those subjects, get a teacher that taught math or taught English or French or whatever, and we could get them all lined up in the girls' high school, use the whole girls' high school, and we could run these classes every night. Students would pay, I don't know how much, I forgot how much they paid, but the money would go to the teachers, because you said it was paying for the operation. The money would go to the teachers. The teachers would be making a lot of bucks. Students would be getting they would be getting what they wanted, which was special help with smaller classes in their areas that they were weak on. And that was going for a while. I don't know what stopped. Let's see. Oh, I think what happened was we just turned it over to the Vietnamese. The idea was, okay, you know, we'll provide the money. You said I'll provide the money. I guess we'll provide the kind of the organization, working with everybody, trying to put all this thing together. And then once we do that, then it's yours when we go away. And so I went to, let's see, I think I got married in there. And then once I got married, because that'd be like 71, no, 70, I got married in 70. And then I went off to DeLotte to teach, University of DeLotte, Catholic University, to teach American history, myth versus the reality, which took five of us to teach, actually. Because there were a couple IVSers and a couple of Fulbright scholars and or Fulbright teachers, whatever. Fulbright scholars.
It's a Fulbright scholar.
Fulbright scholarship. And one Englishman had just showed up who wanted to help out, Benjamin Cherry. And he's a son of a barrister in England, and he's causing all kinds of trouble, so they sent him over to Hong Kong to work out of ships or something. Anyway, he went to Nepal and places like that, ended up in Vietnam, dressed in a suit, carrying a bottle of Pepto-Bismol. Anyway, we took him in and said we can go teach at the university. And then at the same time, I was also teaching at the Vietnamese Military Academy in their lab. I was the American voice. At the University of DeLotte, I taught photography with another. Actually, I taught photography with the. It was a cultural attaché to the embassy, and they had an office in DeLotte. And he and I taught photography. I taught advanced exposition. And five of us together taught. We taught American history, and then we taught some English classes, and that was a point where I decided, I better get some of my journalism stuff going, because you know, after all, was what I'd done before. I'd written some letters home to my editor, and they published those. Mm-hmm. And so I said, I better. We were very poor. The Department of Government and Finance was a very poor school at the university, but that was my school. Mm-hmm. Actually, I taught in two schools, but that was my main school. And they only had one magazine, the Farsi Economic Review. So I said, okay, well, I know how this academic stuff works. You gotta publish. So I said, I'm gonna publish in the Farsi Economic Review. So I embarked on a whole bunch of projects on my free time to do an in-depth study of Binh Dinh Province and why the Americans were gonna lose the war based on what's going on in Binh Dinh Province. Mm-hmm. And the Farsi Economic Review took that and teamed up with another story, and it was a cover for the Farsi Economic Review. And then I did a few other things for them, did an election, and...
Was this about 69, 70? Or, no,
this would be 70, 71.
Okay. Well, I can't wait to read that.
Now,
as soon as I get back to L.A., I'm going to go right over to UCLA. They've got a full collection of Far Eastern Economic Review.
Yeah, look in 70 and 71. I'm probably in there five or six times. One, I did a story on the phantom voters, how people, we kind of figured out a method to figure out how many people were voting, and then we went and got the tally and found out that we figured these were phantom voters. And then also I did one on the Hue, the students at the University of Hue, and why they wanted to get this war over, because as far as they're concerned, North, Central, South, one family. Mm-hmm. And which really disturbed the American press corps, because in that case, my Vietnamese was good enough that I quoted in English what they were saying in Vietnamese. Mm-hmm. The press conference was in three languages, French, English, and Vietnamese. But you're getting there are a lot better quotes in Vietnamese, so I was using the Vietnamese quotes. And when it ran in the Farsi Economic Review, they were asked, it was a fairly prominent newspaper, the AP and UPI, and all these people say, well, hey, you guys with this press conference, where'd you get this stuff? But, and then, and I did a story on, oh, some other stuff, I forget what it was. And then, one day, by this time, I think IBS is falling apart. And, like, there's no IBS. Like, they were kicked out of the country.
Mm-hmm.
But we were all still there. They, like, kicked the organization out, but didn't kick any of us out.
Uh-huh.
So we're sitting there, wow. Anyway, I'm trying to survive. Meanwhile, my wife has got, she had been sick, had to be medically evacuated out of Dalat to Phan Rang Bay, where she was in a coma for a week, and then finally came out of that. And then we were proud to be able to, my son is proud to say that for, you know, all these people trying to fight, stop the war, he successfully stopped the war in 19 for his birth. And so my wife had been in a coma. She'd gone up to, back to the lot. The people, doctors at the lot said, and also their pals said, okay, you might have some trouble with the birth. So if you do.
She had a diabetic coma?
No, she was in a coma because she had a blood infection.
Oh.
And she's 5 months pregnant.
Mm-hmm.
And her mother had just died. And she was quite traumatized. And she had a lot of other things, maybe typhus and some other things.
Mm.
And so, anyway, I brought her back up there to the lot to kind of recuperate. She was pretty wiped out. And then and it was time to give birth, and the Dalat Medical Center doctor said, we can't do her, only an American can save her. And I said, oh, here we go again. So by that time, we'd made friends with our relationship with USAID. They never called it USAID, though. It was like CORD or something like that. the contact, I forget, he wasn't the senior province advisor, but he's like the number two man or something. Anyway, his name is Brian Chastain, a big giant of a guy, bald and carrying a 38, big giant 38. Anyway, I told him.
Brian Chesney?
Chastain.
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 Okay. Right.
I said, Brian, you know, she's broken water already. And the doctors, Vietnamese doctors, said they can't do anything. So he got on the radio and he called an emergency and ordered every aircraft in the vicinity of Tuyen Duc province to land at the Dalat Airport. And then somebody told him the ambassador's jet is on the runway at Nha Trang. So he called down to the ambassador's jet and said, I need its emergency VIP. I need it right away. And it circled, this little red Volpar, little jet, red jet, kind of red and white jet, just circled the airport. My wife had this reel, like, oh, it's for me. And when we went up to the airplane, they said, no, this is for a medical emergency VIP. They had removed some seats in there. And they said, this woman is it. And I said, oh. Anyway, they put her on the airplane, and then they flew down to Saigon, and she was kind of amble, or she was walking, and they said, do you need an ambulance? I said, no, I don't need an ambulance. We're just driving a Jeep over there. And when they got into, when the word got down to Saigon, here was the ambassador's jet with a VIP casualty aboard. They stopped all of the traffic at Tansanet Air Base,
mm-hmm.
all the commercial traffic, all the military traffic. They waved it all off, and we're going. Normally, when you go to Tansanet is so crowded. It was the busiest air base in the history of war. It took you like sometimes an hour, 2 hours to get just a taxi down the runway, and we just went smooth. It was just right in. Got an ambulance, went over to the Third Field Hospital, and a couple hours later, through a cesarean, my son was born. But he'd stopped the war. We figured about 5 minutes. So that had occurred while IBS was kind of falling apart. And so there I was in Saigon. Now, IBS is still there, and the IBS house is there.
Mm-hmm.
And we just kind of were, I went and became the news editor for the Saigon Daily Mirror or something like that. And it was just, my job was just take press releases and stuff and put them all together and then put out a paper.
But you weren't with IBS.
Yeah, we were still
under contract to IBS?
I think I was probably under contract, but I might have been not. I mean, it was the point where with a lot of IBSers, so, and we IBSers got together And we got all the money that IBS had, we got all the Jeeps, and we split them up. And I mean, it was all the you know, regular IBS, and they said, you know, split this stuff up. And so then I went, and then I got a Jeep somewhere. I don't think it was an IBS Jeep. I think it was just made of parts from someplace. Put Bauchi on the front, and went up to Hawaii to do these stories with my son bouncing on the front. Mm-hmm. And I just was a reporter for a while until, oh, then I covered the presidential election when Ventue ran alone. And then also had stories in Newsweek and the San Francisco Chronicle. Mm-hmm. No, I didn't have stories in Newsweek. I had a, they picked up two sentences of mine.
No, okay.
Which I got
still
50
indexed,
bucks
probably.
For. 50 bucks for. Uh-huh. I didn't make much money. But and then I and then they had this okay, then we had the second inaugural. I remember I attended that one. And then they wouldn't renew my visa. So I bought a ticket for my wife and myself and my son, and went to the airport, and they wouldn't let my son go, because he had an American passport. I said, "An American?" I said, "He's American, got an American passport. He's born in Vietnam. You have to have a Vietnamese passport. It has to be attached to his mother, so we went back." They're just messing with us. Because I don't think they liked the last stories that I wrote, because they weren't very friendly to the to you and those people. And, but they did one thing, they did me a favor. Usually when to get out of Vietnam, you had to pay some corruption money. And they didn't try to do that with me at all. They really wanted me to leave. But they didn't. They wanted me to, they wanted to kind of mess with me. So they messed with me. And so the next day I got out and we left the country.
And, well, actually, what I want to do is that there's some points I want to come back to, but just for, as long as we're rolling here with the narrative. When you flew back to the States with your, I assume your wife is Vietnamese.
Yes.
Yes. And so you flew back to the United States. What happened after that? How did that Vietnam connection stay with you? Or, for example, some IBSers had some problems readjusting in the United States. They felt that things moved at a different pace.
Oh, yeah. When you get out of Vietnam and... Well, first of all, one of the things you realize when you leave Vietnam that you've been intensely angry for 4 years. A constant state of anger, but just at the shit you were looking at. I can't believe that we are doing this. You know, constantly you get, and pretty soon you got used to it, and you said, "I can't believe it." And, you know, we were absolutely convinced early on that we were going to lose the war. There's no way we could win the stuff that we were doing. We just destroyed everything. And so I got to Hawaii, and it was just really weird. They'd changed things too. They'd put these little walk, don't walk signs on traffic signals that I'd never seen before, and I didn't know what to do with them. So I just kind of stared at them for a while, and then I think what occurred to me that occurs to everyone is that there's not enough walk time on there. And so, anyway, I did that, and then we just kind of walked around, and I was in a daze. And then I went back to the United States, I went back to California, my parents were in Chatsworth then, and let's see, I worked for the Beverly Hills Courier, but I quit there because it was really a screwy operation. Oh, first I went to work for the Barstow, the Desert Dispatch in Barstow. And then I was only there for a few months. I really liked it. It was kind of an interesting place to be. And there was a lot of history and stuff, a lot of paleontology and archaeology and all kinds of stuff in the desert. I was really interested in, I write about that now, and I wanted to do something.
Amboy Crater.
Hmm?
Amboy Crater.
There's, yeah.
Lots of things out.
Oh, there's, so I thought this was going to be exciting. But then one day I wrote a story about the Indians out there in the desert wresting control of the Head Start program away from the white structure there, the white power structure. That was a really interesting story. So I wrote a story about it. And then I followed up trying to talk to the principals and people involved, and they didn't want to talk. I said, "How can you not talk? It's a public program. You have to talk." And so I wrote, you know, story. They were elected. These people hadn't seen real newspaper people, I don't know, ever. And so then the publisher met me and said, you know, "We've had people like you before, and gave me my walking papers, I was gone. So anyway, so I stayed with my brother again, the Special Forces guy, and I got a job with the Beverly Hills Courier. And I got in there and they said, they have an election for council. And they said, you're just the guy. He says, we're having this little debate and everybody here is kind of prejudiced and you're fresh, so you take this story. And it was a story on whether they should have drug centers in Beverly Hills, because the folks in Beverly Hills didn't want drug centers. Mm-hmm. And so anyway, I did a big story, and I quoted one doctor saying, you know, what do you mean drug centers? Is there more drugs, mind-altering drugs in a Beverly Hills medicine cabinet than any place else, you know, and that kind of stuff. Anyway, I quoted this one millionaire, I think they might have been all millionaires, he was retired, I think he was in insurance or something, but anyway, he was a council member, he's running for re-election, and I quoted him as saying, only a dog would deny people help with their drug problems. I put that in the paper. And the next day he decided he didn't want that in the paper, he didn't want to have said that, he already said it, it's in the paper. And he said, so the publisher said, well, we'll publish a retraction. I said, we can't publish a retraction, that's what he said. And so they said, it appeared on page one. They put the retraction on like on page 60-something. And when I saw that, I was really pissed. Fortunately, when I got home, I got a letter from the editor of the Santa Paula Daily Chronicle offering me a job as a city editor there. So I went over, interviewed, took that job. And then I ran into problems there, too, after about 18 months, about a year, because they were running a secret government, and I used to kind of cover that secret government, and then I decided that, wait a minute, that they would have a city council meeting, but before the city council meeting, like a couple days before, they'd get together and they'd make all the decisions. And so I said, wait a minute, I'm going to start covering those meetings. And I said, you can't do that, you're supposed to cover these meetings. I said, no, I'm going to cover the meetings where it first starts. And so we had a big argument over that. And then I tried to get some public records. And then one day the city manager marched me off to the publisher. And the publisher said to me, and I explained to him the law, the Brown Act and the California Public Records Law. And he said, we don't want to run, you know, we don't want to run things in Santa Paula by laws made way up there in Sacramento. I said, excuse me? And I figured, well, I got to get out of there. So then meanwhile, my wife had come up we'd come up on vacation to San Francisco, and she saw Chinatown, and she said, wow, I want to live up here. So I said, okay. So I looked around for jobs, and eventually got on the Mercury News. And I haven't had a lot of trouble with the Mercury News editors. I've been fired, and I've been here 23 years.
You haven't been fired yet.
Never been fired yet.
Yeah, we have a nose for story. It's quite obvious, so you belong there. If you had to say if there was something, of course, you know, you're still married to the wife.
Yes.
You married?
Yeah, 25 years. 26 years.
Okay. And are there ways in which, I mean, obviously from what you've said, your personality obviously was formed before you went to Vietnam. You kind of knew what you wanted to do. The angle of attack you took at things was pretty mature by then. But are there things are there legacies from your experiences in Vietnam, with IVS in particular, that you carry with you? There's something you think about, influences your work, or your things you're interested in?
I think about Vietnam every day.
Well, I'll give you a small example. A fellow was in Laos for 7 years, and he was a woodworker, and by hobby and then by profession when he came back to the States, and he's very famous at this, I think, or should be. And I asked him, you know, do Laotian themes ever inform the work that you do? And he says he thinks so subconsciously. He says that those lamps back there are the first thing that I did, and they're essentially what the tops of a Buddhist vihara. There's a kind of stepped pinnacle. And these lamps were exactly like that. He said, well, sometimes it's not so unconscious, you know, like that. Is there something like that that you find? Is there some angle or perspective that you've got because of that experience?
Well, you know, I don't think I ever, I mean, I left Vietnam and then it followed me. Mm-hmm. My wife was having a hard time, you know, making all these adjustments, and there was real snotty Vietnamese in the country back in the early 70s, and then here comes 75, and all of a sudden, Vietnamese all over the place, and they reestablished the Vietnamese culture in San Jose, and I still sometimes call San Jose Saigon. And all my wife's family came over, and they were all very young, and they now own 5 restaurants in San Jose. My wife was dressed in an Aozai last night, going down to the restaurant just to help out. I follow Vietnam. She follows Vietnam. I made 2 trips to Vietnam. She's made 30 or 40 trips to Vietnam over the same period. She works in immigration. My kids are Vietnamese. I mean, you know, we were talking about it yesterday. Like, what are we? And I said, well, I think we're Californians. We're probably Bay Areans. But I said, is Dad, are we white? And I said, I don't know. I guess, I don't know. I'm Hispanic and German, and that's kind of white. But for the census, I said, I put down Hispanic. I said, there's 1 Hispanic and 3 Vietnamese in my house. She said, okay. So my house looks like a Vietnamese house. I mean, there are 10,000 books in the house, probably, and half of those are Vietnamese books. I mean, not only Vietnamese books, they're about Vietnam, but I've got hundreds of books that are in the Vietnamese language, because my wife, not only does she read a lot of books and listen to a lot of music, and there's a Vietnamese radio station, a TV station, but she also subscribes to all of the Saigon daily newspapers and reads them every week. And so Vietnam is just part of it's, you know, like the next city over. So it just followed us.
Just to go back to 1975, what did you have any kind of take on that with the fall of Saigon, the quote, fall of Saigon? There's some, I mean, other than, of course, soon a lot of relatives would be coming, but...
Yeah, I covered it. I covered it for the American News. We did lots and lots of stories, and they were very emotional. My wife's family was over there, and they'd been refugees twice by this time now. Mm-hmm. The first time in 54, and the second time, I think, in like 72 or 73 in there, they were refugees again. And, you know, we followed the fall of Saigon on the radio. It was like watching an action movie that just wasn't ending. It was just an incredibly emotional time. And I was writing about it all the time. In fact, we were writing about my wife. My wife's picture was in the paper listening to the fall of Saigon, and she would watch the 727s, I think, of Ed Daly coming out of Saigon with people falling off there, and then we'd look out the window and we'd see a 727 landing in San Jose, and she said, I'll never forget that airplane. Things like that. But eventually, you know, through a process of time, her entire family came over except for one of her younger sisters, who had the misfortune of marrying somebody who was apparently a member of the Communist Party. She was just a kid. Mm-hmm. And they won't let her in the country, so she's in Australia. But all of her other, she's one of the best known Vietnamese in San Jose. Mm-hmm. My daughter was telling her that, you know, everybody knows you, Mom. And
what's her name?
Let's see, how would she be known? She would be known, you know how Vietnamese are, like, yeah. 5 or 6 different names. Yeah. Ho Chi Minh had like 50 of them. Uh-huh. She would be known probably as Quê Hương, just Quê Hương. She goes by Quê Hương, which means if you don't have any access on it, it means mother country. Mm-hmm. But her real name is Quê Hương, but she calls herself Quê Hương, it's mother country. Her real name is Lê Thị Quê, that she had it on the home. And now she just goes by the name of Quê Hương, or sometimes Quê Hương Lê. She doesn't use my name.
Well, it's been interesting because I've met several, to set up interviews, several IBSers who married Vietnamese, but they're divorced. I mean, I haven't had a chance to explore as to why, but also I didn't ask. Some said, you know, it's just 25 years, sometimes you grow apart. You know, they didn't seem to indicate there was a cultural limit or problem.
We've grown a little bit apart, but actually closer in the process, because I'm basically a hermit. Mm-hmm. I like to I like to have my satellite dishes and all my computers and all my equipment, all my stereo equipment, everything. And then just leave me alone. Just don't even talk to me. And she's got all these activities. She goes to every Vietnamese play in San Jose, and they're like three a night, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Works on her sister's restaurant. She's a graphic designer. She's an artist. She's a director of. She's a program director for the Pacific Rim Institute at San Jose State, which is kind of a program she's trying to bring back to life because they cut it so much that it almost doesn't exist. It kind of like it has no staff, but she's trying to bring it back together. She's trying to work out exchange programs between the University of Hanoi and San Jose State University.
Yeah.
So she's always doing these things, and up to this year she was in Vietnam all the time. I used to tell people that she lives in Vietnam and she visits me. So we grew apart that way in that, you know, I have to cook my own meals and all that kind of stuff, whereas she used to do that, and she's gone off and she raised the kids at home all the way up until they were like 16 or 17. Then she went off, went to school, and she went to, they opened up a school near our house, Evergreen College. She went over there, community college, she went there. She didn't speak any English.
Mm-hmm.
She went over there, came out all A's. So they didn't do that, we don't speak English. And then she went over to San Jose State, all A's. Never got anything less than an A.
And on the half an hour, there are some issues I'd like to go back to. Some are fun, some are a little work, but not too much. First, we'll just go down the list really, kind of chronologically. Ham Jordan, as he's called in his hometown. Did you get to work with him at all?
We just kind of went over.
Matter.
See, I didn't know him as chief of staff. All I knew is some guy's really sick,
mm-hmm.
and who kind of shuffled along. And I only knew him. Let's see, I guess I knew him at Harper's Ferry. He's just, I don't know how many of us were in Harper's Ferry, but it was like 30 or something.
Mm-hmm.
So he's one of the 30. And you know, there were there's no reason to single him out. I mean, he wasn't one of my friends or anything. He was in the ag team, I believe. We were on different teams anyway.
Right.
And the only thing I remember about him is that he was always sick, and he wore these floppy go-aheads on his feet. And he just seemed to be sick all the time. And there were a lot of people in Saigon were sick all the time. Good, they weren't going to make it. And I don't think he ever made it. Did he make it?
I don't know.
I don't think he ever got out of Saigon. Yeah, it's happened. It's a very tough country if you're not strong.
No, I know the same thing for India and Afghanistan. We're not star hunting. It's just curious. He's not in. If he received. Our questionnaires, I don't think we've gotten that one back from him.
Yeah, he didn't really have an experience, because I think he came, and then he just wasn't, health reasons left. I think, I'm not sure, but
well, we'll find out, but it reminds me when I get back to Georgia, I should try to contact him and talk to him about that. Looking at this kind of, again, chronologically, the guns at the Tet Offensive, when you passed out the guns, a lot of the folk in IVS were brethren and Mennonites, and there were members of peace churches. I don't know if you know John Balaban.
Just by name.
Because John was like issued an automatic weapon and then told, if anybody comes down that street, you've got to shoot them because they're coming to this hospital, and we have all these wounded that we have to take care of, and you have to defend the hospital. And of course, he went through some agonizing hours sitting there. And said, "What do I do? Well, I'll have to pull the trigger." But John was a CO who went to Vietnam as alternative service. You didn't go to Vietnam for alternative service. So, but what about what was the feeling? You know, with a little group of IVS folk as they passed out the weapons. Was there? And he's not so much second thoughts. Just what did they think about it?
Oh, I don't know. I felt kind of dumb with it because I put a big holster and a red hat, and I was really stupid.
Oh, when you were the special forces, yeah.
But I was just a gun. I mean, I was military trained, so mm-hmm. I mean, it was just a weapon.
But was were weapons issued to any other IVS people
I'm not sure.
Okay, I just may have missed it.
Who was there?
I wanted to clarify that story because it didn't.
Yeah, there were civilians, but I'm not sure. I don't think there were any other. See, I don't remember, but some IVSers were IVSers and then they were USAID.
Right.
And I get them mixed up because we had people. In our area, the USAID people, when they went beyond Queen Anne, would carry weapons.
Mm-hmm.
Our idea was, okay, we just have this weapon just as kind of an alternative, but really, if we ever get captured, we really ought to get rid of it so that we look like we don't have any weapons, because we're not going to fight with anybody.
Right.
But we want to be able to protect ourselves if we have to.
Right.
And we never did.
Right. Second, this idea of USAID and CORDS. Now, of course, CORDS was an umbrella organization that Robert Comer set up to try to put nation building back into a proper perspective. One of the problems in Laos was that that kind of CORDS approach, it wasn't called that, of course, it was just USAID, may have put some IVSers in jeopardy. Because since USAID supplied all of the material equipment for the people out in the field, and since some areas were in contested political areas, it may have compromised some IVSers, may have gotten some of them killed, may not have. There may have been other factors. But the result of that is we have to explore that relationship. Were you aware, when you signed up for IVS, was there any point along the way where you realized you were working under contract to USAID?
Yeah.
When were you first aware of that? At Harper's Ferry, did they?
Probably.
Yeah, because in the letter they...
Harper's Ferry had USAID people.
There were USAID people, because supposedly a couple of IVSers said, if we knew that USAID paid for this, we wouldn't have signed up in the first place. Because they wanted, the reason why they chose IVS is they thought they were participating in a non-governmental organization. And then they got to Harper's Ferry and they realized, oh, gee, this is part of that. But actually, it is IVS. They're just receiving money from USAID, so that's not the same thing. They're not really working for the U.S. government. But
I didn't have any bad feelings about USAID then, because I didn't know anything about it. To me, it was right. an aid program, and I thought the aid programs were good. Later on, I learned that that USAID had some very fine people, but had some people just didn't do their work very well and lied. And so as a result, we didn't know what we were. The leaders didn't know what they were. I mean, they were getting bad information, and I think that happened probably a lot of other. I only know of one case. I mean, Ed Rose. What is it? Rose? I think it was his name. I mean, they were small things, but I went, gee, we're doing this for other things too.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he was issuing reports to please his boss to show some progress, and there wasn't progress, and there shouldn't have been progress. My God, we're in the middle of a war, and Bindin Province was fairly active.
Mm-hmm. Which brings us to me a couple of. Bindin issues. The Korean participation in the war stretched up and down that coast in that particular region. Much has been said about the behavior and policies of Koreans. You mentioned during the Tet Offensive, they blew up the radio station as the cheapest way of eliminating the VC from the radio station. Was that
I'm not sure if the Americans would have done the same thing.
Yeah. Well, maybe they would have.
I wasn't aware of
that. Did Vietnamese in that area have a special fear of Korean troops?
They're scared to death of it. Yeah, they were scared to death of them. They're mean. Mm-hmm. Very. I had two. Well, they would do things like they would skin people and hang them in the square as kind of a warning. You know, And they would, but people feared them. I also liked to see them on the road when I was driving a road, because it meant the road was safe. So, I mean, but the Vietnamese feared them.
By the way, very quickly, but when they left their entire ammunition depot intact, left the gates, and just split. And the VC went in and just started taking all the stuff for themselves. And a local advisor in the province said that probably the casualties in the province were much higher because of that. That the enemy was fully equipped, as they could be.
I think I broke the news that the Koreans had left beyond the next hill over from Queen Anne,
mm-hmm.
because I went through there, and I went and talked to some Montagnard folks, and I noticed while I was going through there that the Koreans were gone. And then I told Newsweek, it was part of my whole thing on Bending Promise. They pulled that out and put it in their story. I think it was the first time that it was reported that Koreans had left. I forget what the name of that valley was. Mm-hmm. But, you know.
Well, a couple of things. Two other things I wanted to talk about. You know, you're very interesting. Of all the IVS personnel, there are probably a couple of the kind of parallel backgrounds, but you were in Vietnam as a soldier before you went in as IVS.
Right.
So you have a unique perspective. There are a lot of people who have that perspective. They've seen the war from more than just one angle. And I think personally you get more realistic. It's less ideologically driven. It isn't less moral. But it's more realistic as opposed to what we call the real world on and off. But in any event, there are two ways of saying when you say something like we couldn't have won that war. I mean, look at the stuff we were doing. Is there a feeling that given what the United States was and how we think and how we act, and given the Republic of Vietnam was what it was and not something else, was there another way of America achieving its objectives? Or was it a situation in which being what these two governments were and being what the enemy was, success wasn't really in the future? I'm not talking about inevitability. I'm just saying that there is a school that says, geez, if we'd only bombed them back to the Stone Age, we would have won. Or if there was some better counterinsurgency, we would have won. And I just wonder from someone who was there, who saw the war from different perspectives, what their take on that failure was.
We were on the wrong side.
Well, go ahead, elaborate. Don't make me feed you things. So Ho Chi Minh was the hero of the... No, go ahead. Yeah,
I think we were on the wrong side. Mm-hmm. As I told the Vietnamese over and over again, I said, boy, if I was a Vietnamese, I'd be a Viet Cong. Mm-hmm. Because the... from a military experience, we were dealing with intelligence, and we were dealing with a totally unstable government that... that changed every, I think it's like every 2 months it was changed. There were coups and demi-coups, and echoing in my mind, I think, was what Kennedy had said earlier, was that in the, I don't know exactly what he said, but he said, it says, in the end, the Vietnamese have to win this war. And they couldn't get their act together. So it was clear from my military experience that they can't get their act together. We didn't fight in combat with them, so I don't know. There are a lot of stories about, you know, great units and lousy units, mm-hmm. and I suppose they had great units and lousy units. I don't think they had the will that the northern soldiers had. They were fighting for their country. I think the southerners were not fighting for the. Maybe some of them were, I'm sure, but they were fighting for capitalism and what. Eventually, the system became more corrupt and more corrupt and more corrupt. And then the people that were like Thieu, I mean, I think at the end, I don't know how many of his generals had really good, solid military experience. They were all political friends of his, mm-hmm. who were in the military, because like everybody's in the military in the war. And the country collapsed. It was, I've seen Vietnam after the communists took over, and they really screwed up the place, too. Mm-hmm. I mean, it didn't look. My wife tells me that the Vietnamese believe that all of this is a punishment, in addition to the typhoons and everything that caused, mm-hmm. for knocking off the Chams. Vietnam is doomed forever.
Mm-hmm.
That's what it looks like. It seems to me that both sides have really hurt the Vietnamese people. Mm-hmm. But if I were going to pick a side, I'd go with the side that was fighting for independence, even though they had the Russians. There was no perfect answer, but I don't think the... I think we were on the wrong side. Sometimes I think about Ellsberg's argument that we were the wrong side. And maybe that was it. We were kind of trapped in history. We started the war with the notion that we were going to hold back the tide of communism. When we ended the war, we had presidents hobnobbing and hugging communists in Moscow and Beijing. You know, you get really confused if you're in Vietnam and you're a soldier and you're saying, "Whoa, what's this war about?" Because when I first went to Vietnam, the soldiers were hard drinking beer or whiskey types. And when I left, they were taking urinalysis tests to see if they were on heroin, and a lot of them were. And the drugs had decimated the U.S. Army, not the Viet Cong.
Did you notice, since you were there for such a long time, and this is not an IVS question, did you notice that there's a William Colby, who I saw actually just before he died, about a week before he died. William Colby has what he calls the lost victory thesis.
I read the book.
You've read the book. Well, I have got him to say something quite different on videotape and on cassette, so I feel a little different. I asked him, without wishful thinking, were the people of the United States correct in abandoning the war after the Tet Offensive, given the situation as they saw it? And he said, absolutely. He says, the American people had every right to withdraw their support from the war after so many years, because simply, it's not a question of democracy losing a war, but in a democracy, you have to show progress. You have to show the people, and of course, this is true of Hanoi, by the way, but you have to show the people that the sacrifice is worth it. And we never showed the kind of progress that was necessary. And therefore, they were correct. So in actual fact, in terms of real time, real history, there is no lost victory. The United States could have maybe in 100 years achieved exactly whatever its goals were in Vietnam.
We seem to do everything wrong.
But,
at the Tet Offensive, mm-hmm. that's when we should have started really jumping on them, because mm-hmm. we beat them. Mm-hmm. We beat them in the Tet Offensive. We beat them so bad that they couldn't function, and the NVA took over. Mm-hmm. And that's when we should have jumped on them. Westman was right on it. I don't agree with a lot of Westman stuff, mm-hmm. but that's when we should have jumped on it. We won the Tet Offensive, mm-hmm. and we should have jumped right on their asses, but we didn't. Instead, we said, okay, it's over, and kind of pulled back. And I don't know if we would have won anyway, because the group that we were trying... We were doing this all over the country. We had Noriega in Panama. We had Marcos in the Philippines. We had somebody in Korea. We had Tew, and they're all corrupt right wingers, anti-communists. But they weren't. You know, what bugs me is these Vietnamese who demonstrate, these immigrants,
yeah.
And they'll say, let's return democracy and freedom to Vietnam. I say, wait a minute. Democracy in Vietnam? I don't think it's a concept that has ever been understood in Vietnam, except maybe at the village level, mm-hmm. but not, certainly not at the national level. And freedom? Give me a break. You know, the Don Luce documented the prisons and the mistreatment of people who had differing political views. You know, what a bunch of bullshit. Mm-hmm. So maybe we're on the wrong side. Maybe we were the wrong side. I think Daniel Ellsberg knows more about what went on than any of us. Kind of my hero.
Well, and I just wrote to him, actually. I was thinking while we were talking that I'll send you a piece that I'm a book that I'm writing, and I've got a manuscript that's the core of it, and I'd be very, very interested in your... Oh, yeah, well, I'm not carrying mine because I've got your address. I don't have to give cards out, but I will send you. Great. My take on it as a historian is that things exist within a time frame. It's like crying wolf. You know, the last time people don't help you, is connected with the fact that the other times they helped you and you didn't use it right or you didn't need it. And then the last time when you really did need it, when you cry wolf, no one pays attention. That's not a rectifiable error at that point. It becomes part of the fabric. So after Tet Offensive, and I want to explore this in the context of what we're talking about, but after the Tet Offensive, seemingly there was an opportunity of fighting a more conventional war, which the United States was prepared to fight. But of course, the United States had already, the purpose of the Tet Offensive was to show the United States that this war wasn't worth prolonging. So in other words, as Von Nguyen Giáp said, and actually Trans Van Tra, who was actually the local commander in the South, he said, hey, all those people didn't die for nothing. They all died for one thing, which is to get you to abandon the war. And you did. And so that was our victory. He says, no victories are just given to you. The American people weren't demoralized by smoke. They were demoralized by blood. And it was our blood. And so they did die for something. But that's what I love about the whole Vietnam conflict. It's so complex. The Tet Offensive is not a victory for the Viet Cong. If anything, it destroys them in the sense that politically, that Pavan plays a greater role, and Hanoi also plays a greater role in controlling affairs in the South. So, but the VC became involved in Tet, as a last effort to try to win the war quickly before the North had taken over the whole apparatus.
Yeah, the Vietnamese...
this is a theory.
The Viet Cong that were left, the so-called Viet Cong, whatever you call them, that they were so dismayed at what happened when Hanoi took over after 75 that by 78 or so, no, sometime into the 80s, they were going up and down to California trying to solicit help from the immigrants and doing something. They wanted to restart the Vietnam War.
Mm-hmm.
There were hundreds of little groups out there trying to do it. Some of them were doing things.
Oh, yes, yes. There's a whole part of the War Crimes Museum in Saigon, which is devoted to the destruction of rebels against the government. There's a little hall of rebels, so to speak. But
a lot of those were from San Jose, too.
Yes, I know, and it doesn't translate well into English. But when you go there, if you know anything about Vietnam, you know what that's there for. It's to label them war criminals with the Americans and the French that got that guillotine and courtyard to make sure everyone doesn't miss that connection. But I wonder, just as a practical thing, when you were in... when you were in Binh Dinh in let's say from 70-71, did you notice, I would imagine in that area you'd notice a diminution of Viet Cong activity? Did it seem to, was it safer and more secure?
In 71 I was in Da Lat.
But you moved to Da Lat, yeah.
Yeah, in...
but between 69 and 70. Mm-hmm.
69 and 70, the Americans were leaving. Yeah, there was less because the targets were leaving, for one thing. I mean, they were, the airport, all those folks were gone. Most, in fact, almost all the Americans were gone, left before I left. They were gone. We had to switch, let's see, how did we fly? I think we were flying out of Phu Cát. I think the Queen Anne Airport shut down. They were gone. The hospital was gone. The helicopter people were gone. The airport, they were all gone. Mm-hmm. In 71.
Mm-hmm.
71, they were gone. And in Da Lat, they were, the Americans were not, the Americans had a very, almost nothing military presence in Da Lat. I think they had they kind of ran the airport and got the gasoline up there, and they didn't do much else.
Mm-hmm.
And Da Lat was a little bit different because they had this Vietnamese Arvin terror squad that went through, and I guess they were probably part of the Phoenix program, and they were just the meanest son of a bitches around. And they would alternately rip through the infrastructure of the Viet Cong and then come in and rip apart the lot. They're real animals, but they were I never ran across any groups like that. They would dress up as Viet Cong, mm-hmm. and commit atrocities, according to the folks I was talking to. I think Colonel Hebert wrote about some of that stuff in his book.
Did you find that... just a couple of questions left. Did you find that you found it easy to talk to Vietnamese at a personal level as opposed to talking to someone who's just saying things to please you, to be polite? Did you break past that barrier?
I had a few close friends, uh-huh. and we mostly had to communicate in English because my Vietnamese wasn't that good.
Mm-hmm.
So my close friends spoke English. And were helping with my Vietnamese, and I think they were mostly other teachers, and they were probably as a boss.
Do I send in food or something?
No, we're going to be done very shortly. Thanks a lot, though. Yeah.
Do I get a lockup?
You get the lockup.
Okay.
The last guy.
Thank you very much.
Okay. There was a small group I could talk to, mostly who spoke English. Speaking Vietnamese with people, I could buy things, I could ask for directions, didn't have a close relationship. I had a family that was fairly close to me, my wife's family, and I were fairly close. Some of her sisters didn't like me because they didn't like Americans. Still don't, and they're here when they still don't. There was a small group of professional contact and then my personal contact, so a small group. I could talk to anybody. Binh Dinhers don't like anybody. They don't like Saigon, Hanoi, and they certainly don't like French and Americans or anybody. So, and in Da Lat, it was a lot friendlier. The students were great. The faculty was very friendly. In Da Lat, it was mostly just professional relationship.
Mm-hmm. When Saigon fell, Did you have any thoughts that maybe some of the people that you taught were now on hit lists or re-education camp lists, or, I mean, outside of your family, I know there was a concern for them, but was there a sense that many of the people that you worked with were jeopardized because of the contacts they had with Americans in those years?
No, I think most of the people, some of them, and they got out. Most Vietnamese, I mean, these were Vietnamese that I could tell if I were a Vietnamese, I'd be a Viet Cong. Mm-hmm. And they were probably Viet Cong.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the students at the university, you know, they understand what's going on. I say, you know, they were probably Viet Cong. I have no way of knowing, but I know a lot of reporters, like people have written in their book, Pete Arnett, for example,
mm-hmm.
when he went to the AP office, all the folks there, they were all, we didn't call them Viet Cong, there's another word for them, I don't know what, the Yai Pham, I think the Vietnamese called them,
mm-hmm.
the revolution.
Mm-hmm.
They were the revolutionaries. So I wasn't too, the ones who were really, really, really American who had you buy things for them in the PX and had to have stamps and stuff, those people had to get out.
Mm-hmm.
And there were only two that I remember, three, they all got out.
Mm-hmm.
One of them died of cancer in San Jose. His wife had died before in Quinon when they were having a campfire. This is after, before 75, when they threw a hand grenade and killed her. It killed a lot of people. And she was really neat. She's a French teacher. And a couple of people that are gone, and I went to see them. I went to see those types of people in Quinon in 1989. I went looking for some of them, and they were really scared. People came to me outside of the hotel,
mm-hmm.
and said, "Says you're Thai Da?" And I said, "Yeah." So the word already got through all. You know, we teach your rock,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And we talked with one guy, I'll never forget him, looking at his eyes, he had this look like, you left me here, you know, and I said, shit. And then later I was told that do not visit any of these people's houses, because every place you've gone, immediately a group of cadre came in and interviewed them, like, what'd you tell this American, blah, 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 and they were in trouble. So they made me, for the rest of the day, they made me go off somewhere.
This is in 87?
87, yeah. Quinon is a very communist place.
Mm-hmm.
And I did meet with the chairman of the city, and he had a kind of a, his fingers were missing. I said, hey, where'd you lose your fingers? And he said, up on that hill over there, and I was doing a mortar and dropping mortar on the Americans and stuff. And it was right near my house, right above my house. So he was on the other side up there. But, so I did see some. I did see the fear in their faces, and I did hear some bad stories about. And then of course I did the series on hidden horrors. I mean, I did the story for the Mercury News on the question was, whatever happened to the people who were left behind?
Mm-hmm.
Well, they went to re-education camps, and I did the whole story on how the re-education camps were. I interviewed over 100 Vietnamese in L.A., San Jose, Orange County, Washington, D.C., and New York, and interviewed the folks at the U.S. mission. And then I checked out some of the things going to Vietnam, you know, some of the torture folks. And I did a big package on the hidden horrors of Vietnam, which was the re-education camps.
Mm-hmm.
That's where they went. That's where the folks that we left behind went.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them for 5 years, or some of them for a short time, a few months. And a lot of them for, what, 20 years or something?
It seemed to be according to their rank, the more serious the connection with the government, the longer the term.
But I was able to recreate the radio broadcasting, the announcements and instructions they were made, and we documented the camps that they were in. Aurora Foundation, which was an off-branch of Amnesty International,
mm-hmm.
helped me do the kind of research, because with prisoners you have to do special research. You have to kind of do a written questionnaire type thing,
mm-hmm.
so you can cross check, because sometimes they make up stories.
So I followed through.
They gave me an award.
Mm-hmm.
The Political Prisoners Association of San Jose gave me a big award during Tet back a few years ago. I got a plaque from them, and then and then they kind of ignore me, because they get the sense that I don't really like them all that much.
Well, last question. I mean this in the most general possible way to interpret it in any way you want, but did IVS do any good in Vietnam? Do you feel that your experience there, in terms of doing something in humanitarian assistance, do you think that there were positive things in the balance? Or would have been better for America never to become involved in the country? But speaking directly about the IVS experience.
I think we did a lot of good. Mm-hmm. I think we taught them that there are different kinds of Americans. I mean, they've seen soldiers, they've seen USAID people, they've seen the Colby civilians, of course, and they saw us. And of course, we were young and brash and proud. Most Vietnamese would have nothing to do with this. But some Vietnamese, in my case, in areas of influence, education at the university level, we got to meet and saw that there were different kinds, because we were not motivated by money, because we didn't make any. We were motivated by adventure. We wanted adventure and fun and fulfillment and good parties and a good rowdy class session, you know. That's what got us going. And so we provided a different kind of Vietnamese, of American than they would have normally seen. Mm-hmm. I think we were kind of like cultural attachés in a way. At least in the education field, because we didn't get involved, or I didn't get involved, and the people around me didn't get involved in the politics of it, mm-hmm. except to the extent that we would say, you know, I'd be Viet Cong, why aren't you a Viet Cong, type stuff, because that was just frustration. But I think we did a lot of good. I just reading the reports. I think the rice. I bet you, if you look at the rice mm-hmm. that they're using now, I think mm-hmm. IVS really helped in the production of strains of rice that could not only were good to eat, but provided multi crops. I think it was IVS that introduced a lot of fruit yeah. in the Dalat area.
Yeah, I'm hoping to find someone who worked in the ag in that, because they're quite proud of that.
Yeah, Steve Swift and Steve Swift, his wife worked in that. Steve Swift, Sabrina in Hawaii, worked in that. And then there's Chuck Crumpton, because he was with me, and Chuck Crumpton and his wife, he has a Vietnamese wife, I forget her name. Ooh. Anyway, they're both in Hawaii. Chuck Crumpton was with me. We spent
a lot.
In Queen Anne. We spent a lot of time rocking. We wrote so many memos we started calling.